So David Kubisnek's going to be the tutor for this course, and I'm going to start off by giving a lightning review of things from differential geometry. So I know that you guys have seen this before, so it is going to be quick, but hopefully it'll all be reasonably familiar and you know, useful to see it again for a second time. So one of the sort of interesting things about Einstein's gravity, or one of the things I like, is the fact it's basically like applied differential geometry. We're removing the notion of forces and instead sort of introducing this concept of curved space-time so that straight lines on a curved manifold can look curved, and therefore it looks like there are forces present. And so there's quite a lot of mathematical background in general relativity, although it's quite possible to go quite a long way without being too sophisticated with the mathematics. So just as a record, you know, again asking you to recall, so what really do we mean by curved spacetimes or curved manifolds? Well, we have this description of a manifold, which we usually draw as something rather like an amorphous blob, that looks locally like R to the n. And then we kind of dress that up with some mathematical meaning to see what we mean by looks locally like. So we have this concept of charts that map us, little regions of our manifold, into regions of R to the n. And then if we have an overlap of charts, we ask that in the overlap, in the underlying sort of normal Cartesian manifold, that these things have properties of differentiability. So we usually take infinitely differentiable. So this is our concept of the manifold. It's some set of events. If it's space-time, then they're ordered by time. They're sort of relations in time, something's to the past or to the future. And we cover our manifold with an atlas of charts. So that should be all familiar. And our local charts, we usually interpret as our coordinate system. So we'll often write x mu or x prime, mu prime, or whatever. We have some set of values of r to the n that we're associating with the points in our manifold. And then you would have seen structure being slowly built on that. So as a reminder, we introduce functions, which is the space C infinity of m, sets of infinitely differentiable functions. And of course, we use the structure, this relation with our charts, to define what we mean by differentiable. So what we're always doing is we're kind of importing the structure that we know from Rn into the manifold. So, you know, we say we've got a function on a patch here, we map it over to the little image here in R to the n, and as long as that's differentiable, that's what we mean. We then know what a curve is. So curve sort of goes the other way. It takes a patch of the real line and maps it into our manifold. And the curve could be something like a world line of a particle or some particular curve in space. It's just something that looks locally like the real line. So here's our interval AB mapping into an interval here. And once again, we want it typically to be infinitely differentiable. And then vectors are introduced via these curves, and they're defined as tangents to the curves. So here we might have a, let's see, draw it there, tangent vector t to the curve at a particular point. Let's get a new board. I've got to relearn these boards now. So we simply say if we have a curve gamma and one of our functions, then that defines for us a function f of t by simply just taking the values of f along the curve gamma, and then we just differentiate with the parameter t on the curve gamma. So gamma of t is our curve, and d by dt sort of represents the tangent vector. So we sometimes write t, our tangent vector, is t mu d by dx mu. Because if we were looking, again, with this notion of our manifold as being locally like r to the n, then if we want to differentiate our function f, we've got an f of t, but then we could say, well, you know, the points along the curve are x mu of t in our local chart, so we can do part our sort of composite here of df by dt is df by dx mu, and then these t mu. So these form the tangent space, it's a vector space, again, you saw this either in classical mechanics or some foundations, but it's just in case the notation's slightly different. And then covectors. Well, a cotangent space is defined on a vector space as being maps from the vector space into the reals. So we say that if we've got a vector, we have a map here that takes us from a vector into the reals, and we can denote it either by this sort of omega of v. This is just a slightly different notation, sort of like your Brahm-Ket notation, which is sort of, you know, quite akin to, again, a cotangent and a tangent space. And then, of course, what we'll be most used to seeing in the context of general relativity is this last expression, which is like a contraction of the vector with the covector. So we, just like we wrote our vector over here as t mu d by dx mu, we'll often write our covector in terms of components. So this just brings me to a sort of small subtlety that's probably worth pointing out, because it can be confusing if you haven't seen it before. But this is just, we call it abstract index notation. So it's just being, it's being sort of slightly precise. It was thought of by Penrose because, of course, Penrose is, it was sort of quite on the mathematical end of gravity. And so he wanted to be, to kind of try and be clear about what we do as physicists versus what people do as mathematicians. So as physicists, we often want to just write T mu as a vector. And we operate on that quantity T mu as if it was a vector. But strictly speaking, T mu here are components of a vector in a particular basis, and therefore they're sets of scalars. So there's a mathematician will take a different perspective on what T mu means. And so rather than have physicists called being wrong, Penrose came up with a fancy name for it, saying, no, we're doing the right thing. It's called abstract index notation. So for the most part, when we're doing anything, you know, concrete, doing calculations, things we're trying to work out, we'll use this abstract index notation. But just for this very early part where we're kind of building the formalism of differential geometry, I'm probably going to use more this slightly more mathematical way of writing things. So if I want to kind of deconstruct here, I'll just rewrite this down. This T is the vector. The T mu are the components. And the D by DX mu is the basis. So the reason, this sort of probably seems like nitpicking, and it is to some extent, but it's simply that when discussing some of the things to do with connections, you'll kind of see that if I differentiate the T mu, I don't add connection components, and that's because strictly they're scalars. So the connection comes from differentiating the basis. So when we do a coordinate transformation, we have to transform the components of our vectors. Whenever we change basis, it means that the components change, and therefore we have to do a coordinate transformation. And the vectors, the V prime is on the top, so the X prime is on the top, the mu prime index, whereas for the omega, the mu prime index is on the bottom, so the X prime's on the bottom. So if you're very good, if you've got the sort of mind for detail or whatever, so that you're always careful with your indices, you will never be in any doubt about how things transform under coordinate transformations because you just match up the indices. Here, this mu index is something being summed over, so it's like a dummy index. And if we've got one on the top, it's got to be on the bottom. And the mu primed here is on the bottom, so it has to be on the bottom there. So when we do differentiation of a vector or the components of a vector, if we see what happens under a coordinate transformation, we see that we don't get something, this again should be very familiar to you, we don't get something that is simply a tensor or transforms as a tensor. The first bit is a tensor or looks like a tensor, so we're happy with it, whereas the second bit is something else. And so we don't like it. And so what you see, or what you've discovered, is that we have to find ways of making differentiation work on manifolds. Now, the reason this isn't working is that when we take derivatives, we're normally comparing something, f of x plus delta x minus f of x. And so we're comparing something at x plus delta x with something at x. Now, if you've just got functions on the real line, that's fine. But here we're on a manifold. And if we go to a different point, we're in a different tangent space. So we're trying to compare things in different tangent spaces. And it's not a good thing to do unless you have rules that tell you how to get from one tangent space to the other. So the classic, of course, for doing GR is the connection. So we'll do that last. And the connection is something that isn't a tensor, but it's kind of gives you a way of linking all of these tangent spaces, TP of M, together. So it's kind of a structure on the set of tangent spaces that tells you how to transport yourself from one to the other. So that's your parallel transport notion. And so that's how we come to this notion of geodesics in our space-time. And then I know David also told you about the Lie derivative. So the Lie derivative is another way of getting from one point to the next. And the way the Lie derivative does it is it says if you're flowing along some vector field, if you go along in the direction of some vector field, that gives you a means of connecting the tangent spaces along that particular vector field. So that also works because it gives you a rule for connecting tangent spaces, but it's not a generic rule. It's something that's very much tied to the specific vector field. And then the other thing that you can do, which again you've also seen, is exploit the fact that partial differentiation commutes, so that this extra piece is symmetric. And so if you can somehow anti-symmetrize derivatives, then you can get rid of that piece and maybe have something sensible. So that's what I wanted to start off with, and that is to talk about forms and exterior derivatives. So again, I know you've had an introduction to this, but maybe, you know, go over it, but perhaps take slightly longer this time. That was definitely a lightning review. So what I want to do is to just start by making an observation. And that is, if we have a function on the manifold, we can actually define something that looks like a covector by simply taking its partial derivative. And in a basis, it would be taking a partial derivative sort of with respect to the local coordinates. So we've taken our function, we've just taken its derivative along each of the coordinate directions, and then we've contracted that with our basis, dx mu, and we're going to call that df. So really, if we were imagining our function on the manifold, we would sort of think, well, you know, it's going to have surfaces of constant f if we're in an n-dimensional manifold. Surfaces of constant f are going to be n minus one dimensional. And so our df, we can think of, so this might be f equals constant curves. And so if we wanted to think geometrically, what is df, then we would sort of imagine drawing a little line here and saying, well, that's the direction in which f is changing. Now, it's slightly illegal doing that because when I draw an arrow, and immediately we intuitively think of a vector. But that's simply because, of course, we're most used to thinking about R cubed and flat R cubed at that. And so the distinction between vector spaces and covector spaces is extremely blurred there. They're basically the same thing. But it's a good way of having a sort of visual notion. Really, what it is more is this sort of collection of these f equals constant surfaces. But df is telling you about how f is changing. And if you want to think about how f is changing, you ask, where is it constant? Because then you see, well, how are those constant surfaces evolving as you move through the manifold? So that's our starting point for D, but it's obviously just on functions. So if I want to get fancy, I've just written it down there. If I want to give you a proper definition in this case, so what it means is that if I have this property of this d of f, is if I pick any point in the manifold and any vector in the tangent space at that point, then I take the contraction of df with t, then that has to equal tf at that point. So that was how we defined our vectors in the first place. So that's really, that would be the mathematician's way of stating what I just sort of drew there. And visualized in terms of my differential of f. So if I want to extend this D to tensors, I have to have antisymmetric tensors. So these are what we call forms. An antisymmetric tensor is one of these forms. So, We've got an intuitive notion of what the forms are. We just take a completely covariant tensor, make it anti-symmetric. That's what we mean. If we want to be a little bit fancier and say, how do we construct these things? Well, we construct them out of taking anti-symmetric tensor products of other tensors. So if we start off with our wedge product, if we have two one forms, A and B, then our wedge product is the anti-symmetric tensor combination. It's A tensor B minus B tensor A. So this would be how we would construct a two form. We simply take, like we construct tensors, we take the sort of spanning space of these simple, breaking it down into sort of simple tensor products. We do the same with the wedge product. It's sort of these, it's formed by taking anti-symmetric tensor products. And so in components, so hang on, this is a two form here. So if we want to take a general wedge product, we simply take the components of each of our forms, pop them together like that, A, B, anti-symmetrize over absolutely every index we can find, and then add a few combinatorial factors to make everything balance out. So P and Q are the rank of the forms, A and B. And in the example at the top, both P and Q would be 1. And so this P plus Q factorial is just the combinatorial factor that comes from this full anti-symmetrization here. So you see that if P and Q are 1, you recover the top line. So wedge. It's a linear map, it's a linear combination, but not commutative. Oops, B wedge A. So you can think of it, if you look at the index notation there, you can see why you get this minus sign, because if you swap the order of A and B, you have to pull each of these indices sitting on A through each of the indices sitting on B. And because this is an anti-symmetric ordering, every time you swap two indices, you get a minus sign. So for each A index, you get Q minus signs pulling it through the B indices, and you've got P of the A indices in the first place. So it's not anti-commutative either necessarily. It depends on the rank of the forms. So we can, if we think about this now as an anti-symmetric tensor, it's sort of reasonably obvious. We can't just carry on building anti-symmetric forms as big as we like. We can only go up to the dimension of the manifold. Because if we then try to pack in an extra index, then the final sort of slot there would be linearly dependent on all the others. So we've only got n different linearly independent directions. So if we then add, if we anti-symmetrize over two direction, you know, two things in the same direction, we get zero. So our n form is a multiple of, it's got to be anti-symmetric, it has n indices, so in four dimensions, our n form is just a multiple of epsilon a, b, c, d in n dimensions a1 to an. And it's a scalar multiple of that, but you know, everything that you try and do always ends up boiling down to that alternating symbol. So our alternating symbol is strictly a tensor density. So if we were to write it as a tensor, or to try and think of writing it as a tensor, we would take our alternating plus or minus one times wedge product of all of these coordinate basis covector elements, and this would be what we would naturally think to write down. But then if I do a coordinate transformation, for each of these dx mus, I replace it with a dx mu by dx prime mu prime, dx mu prime, x prime mu prime, prime everything, then if I then look at what I have, the alternating symbol with what is essentially a matrix, this is just the definition of the determinant of a matrix. So this combination here, under a coordinate transformation, it's the definition of a determinant. And so what we've got here, and I apologize, I'm used the wrong font there, is something, the second bit looks like a tensor. So this is sort of tensorial in nature. But you've got this determinant factor out the front, and this is called the weight. So it's not that you don't want to use this quantity, you know, the epsilon tensor, you just kind of generalize a little bit what you mean by tensors and allow a determinant of the transformation to come in. So if we have a metric, what we do, and this is quite an important tensor, is we define our curly epsilon now as the alternating symbol times the square root of det g. And this is now a tensor. Let me check. So the reason it's important is it allows us to go between P forms and N minus P forms. So it gives us additional structure on our sort of wedge product, our form space. So this flipping between N forms and N minus P forms and N minus P forms is called the star operator. It's a Hodge dual. So I'll just shift to...
Is the formula that you give specific to four dimensions, right?
So no.
Spherical.
Oh right, in that one. No, I don't think so. Just because I was just quickly writing down. Let me just make sure of that answer because.
Okay.
No, it's fine. It's or we can just check right at the end. No, it was just David said, oh, you know, they've done all this stuff. Just go through it quickly. So I was quickly, you know, trying to extract the details, you know, of what we were doing. I'm just wondering if jet lag's going to allow me to think on the hoof. Should we come back to it at the end? Yep, I'll come back. We'll take a look at the end. So put a little star or a little footnote there. We'll come back and check this at the end. My feeling is it's okay, but I've just, as I say, I don't know if anyone else here has just come back. I think you're all really brave to be here on the 3rd of January, to be honest, but anyway. So our dual operator takes us from P forms, which we kind of encode as a big lambda, to N minus P forms, and we write it as A goes to star A, but if we usually need to know what that means, we need to know about it in detail, and so what is star A? So what we do is we use the epsilon tensor to mop up the p indices of the A, you know, the form A, leaving us with n minus p. So we need the metric to be able to do this operation, but it sort of gives us extra structure and tells us a lot more about what's going on in the manifold. So our exterior derivative your answer to your question is, in fact, yes, it is G in any number of dimensions. Sorry, I just couldn't see. The reason is that if you look at how things transform, so this is how the alternating symbol is transforming here, and then you've got to figure out how det G transforms. So G has two indices, so each index kind of has a dx prime by dx in it. So the det transforms as dx prime by dx squared. So you get, so the root g has just one factor of det of the of dx prime by dx. Yeah, so, sorry. So D takes us from P forms to P plus one forms. And the way mathematicians define it is they give sort of three conditions. It reduces to df on functions. It's what we would call pseudo-Leibnizian. So normally when you're talking about derivations, you define them as being sort of, you know, operators which take you from, you know, one, you know, a vector to a tensor or whatever, but you're always having this, the key property of a derivation is this Leibnizian property. Now we can't have pure Leibniz. Leibniz would be dA wedge B is dA wedge B, dA wedge B plus A wedge dB. Here we've got forms. We've got this anti-symmetrization floating around. So we know that there's a possibility of a minus sign in there. But as soon as we take account of that, it's essentially Leibnizian. And so that's like the smoking gun of our derivation. And then finally, d squared has to be zero. So these are our three properties. And then you can show that this is what we know as D. Which is a completely anti-symmetrized partial derivative of our the components of our covector. So we can see from that why that takes care of the problem of the coordinate transformation way of looking at whether we've got vectors here, because that's at the top, because the bit by which we didn't have a tensor was symmetric in the derivatives. So if we have an anti-symmetrized derivative, then we should, by all means, be able to cancel off the bit that doesn't work. And indeed, that is what happens. If we write down this relation for our derivative and look at what happens under a coordinate transformation, you see that any terms that would cause trouble are deleted because they are symmetric and we're anti-symmetrizing. So what I've written down there really is a tensor under coordinate transformations. That's the sort of classical way of thinking about tensors. So it's kind of nice just to see an example, I think, of where forms get used. So I'm just going to, write down just what's going on for familiar examples. So when, you know, when we're undergrads, we meet vector calculus, we learn about grad, div, curl, et cetera, et cetera. And so if we ask what is, so this is R cubed, what is dV? If we think about what is dV if V is just a one form. Now, again, I said in R cubed, there's a bit of a blurry line between vectors and covectors. So in essence, I'm sort of, you know, you could almost think of V as being a vector, but let's sort of think about what this is. So it's an anti-symmetrized derivative. So I'm going to have zeros all the way down the diagonal. And my bottom corner is going to simply be given by the top corner up to a sine. So if I look what's in my component here, so this is vy, x minus vx, y. So here I'm looking at the 1, 2 component. So it's d1 of v2 minus d2 of v1. So here, if my p is just 1, I get a 2 form when p is 1. And if p is 1, all I've got is dA1 or dA of AB minus dB of VA. I need more space here. So this component now is 1, 3. So that's dx of vz minus dz of vx. And then the final one, which is in the 2, 3 slot, so that's going to be dy of vz minus dz of vy. So this is what I get, plus this, the anti-symmetric bit over here. So this is a 2 form, but in 3 dimensions, a 2 form is dual to a 1 form by the Hodge dual. So if I look at star dv, again, I'm going to write this just in a more of a sort of traditional vector format. So this is, if I look at my, what do I do when I take a dual? I take my epsilon tensor. Here, I've got just 3 indices on my epsilon tensor. So I've got epsilon x here, ij, di, vj, epsilon y, ij, di, vj, and epsilon z, ij, di, vj. So that's just taking each component in turn, and all it's doing is really picking out these pieces here. So we recognize D of V as essentially just being the curl. It's taking an anti-symmetric derivative and then dualizing that 2 form back to a 1 form using the epsilon tensor. And then similarly, what is df? Well, that actually is sort of related to what I sketched when I was discussing what df was, something I was drawing surfaces of constant f. And so we have this interpretation there of df as simply just being grad f. So that's always, it's always very useful when you're thinking about things on manifolds to go back to a very familiar case, which is R cubed vector calculus. And it's always kind of useful just getting pictures so that you've got something firmly in mind which will lead you through when you start curving your manifold. And so finally, just to note that with this, using this star operator, we can also define a derivation that takes us from lambda p to lambda p minus 1 by saying we first of all take our form, we dualize it, then we take d of the form, and then we come back again and dualize it, and we get down to a p minus 1 form. And so if I do this in my r cubed, div v, or we'd write this, is actually minus delta v. That's what this delta is. It's like the divergence in R cubed. So then, of course, there's a whole branch of mathematics sort of behind all this, all of this structure here, because we can think, well, we know d squared is zero, so if I write a form, say if I write a one form omega as df, then d omega is zero. So if I have a one form such that, you know, d omega is zero, can I write it as df? And so that's kind of where the answer, looking for whether you can or cannot write it as df, the answer sort of reveals interesting things about the manifold that you're dealing with. So there's a whole sort of interesting branch of mathematics that's behind this, and it tells you about structure, the topological structure of the manifold. So we won't sort of be doing that particularly, because of course our emphasis is more on gravity, but this sort of topic is behind some really nice sort of neat stuff that you may or may not come across at a later date. So I just wanted to finish off by just talking a little bit about, or reminding you of, the Lie derivative, which I know you've done, but what I'm not so sure is whether you discussed its geometrical significance. So I thought I'd just wrap up by reminding you what the Lie derivative is, and, you know, saying again why it evades the issue with the problem of differentiation, and just saying what, you know, why do we like it. So so you saw the Lie derivative introduced by saying that you have some additional vector field which defines for you, let's say it's U, defines for you some curves. So these are the integral curves of U. You're simply saying that at every point along this curve, the tangent vector is U. And so if you're at a point P, you can move just a little bit here to a point P plus delta P. And so then you use, you use again structure from differential geometry about maps. You kind of push forward your vector from P to P plus delta P. You compare it with the vector at P plus delta P, divide by delta P, so to speak, and you get the Lie derivative. So for a And so what you see for vectors is you see this anti-symmetric structure cropping up again. And because the Lie derivative of a vector is a vector, it's a map from TP of M cross TP of M into TP of M. And so we sometimes, it gets denoted by a bracket because it is really, it's algebraically like a bracket or commutator. And then, of course, for the covector, so in each case, what we do is we take the first bit is always the partial derivative of whatever you're taking the Lie derivative of, contracted along the vector field. And then the rest is for each index of whatever you're taking the Lie derivative of, you take the partial derivative of the vector field U and contract it appropriately either with your covector or vector. After having got, I think I'm just going to make one comment and stop because I sort of feel I've got to play virtuous and finish, you know, exactly an hour after I started, after having chased off the previous lecturer. So let me just make a small comment, and I'll start next time with a geometric picture. So that was what I was saying before about this commutator, UV. And so our commutator, UV, remember vectors were maps from C infinity of M, you know, into C infinity of M. It was taking F to df dt. So all we do is we say, first of all, I take vf. That's also a function. Then I take uf. And then I subtract off the other way around. So even if I hadn't gone through, or David had to be more accurate, hadn't gone through the whole process of telling you how you shift along these integral curves here, I could still have defined this as a commutator. So I could have still done this. Because vectors are maps from C infinity of M to C infinity of M, I can do one, then the other, and then reverse the process and see if I get something different. And so what we'll just look at tomorrow is that this process of reversing is essentially saying how much the operation of going first in one direction, then the other, is not the same as going in the other direction and then the first. Okay? So... good point to stop.